thank all Muslims and Arabs who support the Palestinian people, especially the Axis of Resistance.
People from all walks of life attending the rally called on all Palestinian factions to increase the resistance against the Israeli occupation to bring about the liberation of Al-Quds.
We will continue to support Hamas and the resistance until we liberate every inch of our land. We call on the Muslim nation to support Palestine and to support Al-Quds. People came out today to send a strong message of support to the resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Hamas supporters said they want the Israelis to know that the Islamic resistance movement is a force to be reckoned with.
We are here today to express our support to Hamas on its anniversary and to tell the whole world that Palestinians are supporting the resistance. Hamas has a very strong military wing that continues to grow. Hamas, along with all the resistance factions, will continue to fight for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
35 years on, Hamas continues to garner support due to its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime.
People here say that despite years of siege and multiple wars, Hamas movement has managed to defy all odds and survive all attempts to weaken it. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The implementation of a comprehensive strategic partnership between China and Iran is getting a kickstart as a high-ranking delegation headed by the Chinese Vice Premier Hu Chunhua meets with Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi in Tehran. After his meeting with the Iranian president, the Chinese top official met with Iran's finance minister, where the two sides signed 16 MOUs to boost cooperation in different fields. Oil and gas, banking, investment, and strategic projects are the four fields of economic cooperation that are now on top of the agenda. There has already been a roughly 20% increase in trade, and the outlook for 2023 is even higher, according to Iran's finance minister. China is still Iran's biggest oil client, despite Washington's bid to bring Tehran's exports down to zero. And its close involvement in the built-out of Iran's manufacturing infrastructure is seen entirely in line with its Belt and Road Initiative. Analysts say this could represent a shift in the global balance of the oil and gas sector and create new markets where no U.S. dollars are involved.
Iran-China relations date back to the ancient Silk Road. Both countries have always had close ties, but over the past couple of years, their relations have become even more significant, with the U.S. putting pressure on China on the one hand and placing sanctions on Iran on the other. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Relatives, family members, and a group of activists gathered in front of the Swedish embassy in Tehran to demand the release of former Iranian judiciary official Hamid Nouri, who has been sentenced to life imprisonment by a Swedish court. The protesters condemned the politicized verdict issued against Hamid Nouri, who has been kept in solitary confinement for over 3 years.
On the one hand, by issuing a verdict against Hamid Nouri, the former Iranian official, based on accusations leveled by MKO terrorist group, Sweden has actually recognized the terrorist group and has allowed its members to live freely on its soil. On the other hand, during the legal procedure, Hamid Nouri has been deprived of his legal rights to defend himself properly in the court because he could not have access to an independent lawyer. He had no contact with his family for 8 months and he has been under white torture.
Earlier, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian called on the new Swedish government to immediately release Hamid Nouri, saying the politicized case of Nouri and efforts by the Mujahideen Khalq organization MKO terrorist group to disrupt a legal probe into the case have seriously harmed relations between Tehran and Stockholm.
We demand that justice be done with regard to my father, because according to many lawyers, the Swedish court verdict against my father was totally politicized and has no legal ground, and there is no concrete evidence for providing the accusations against my father. Therefore, we condemn the court ruling and demand his immediate release.
Swedish authorities alleged that Hamid Nouri was involved in the execution and torture of the MKO members in 1988. He has strongly rejected the allegations.
According to Iranian officials, keeping an individual in solitary confinement for 3 years is tantamount to torture, which runs against EU Convention on Human Rights. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
More picket lines and travel disruptions as tens of thousands of rail workers across Britain walk out. Represented by the RMT union, for months they have been asking the government for better working conditions and an increase in their pay to match the double-digit inflation. The government says the pay rises are unaffordable and has promised tough action against the unions. The unions say they're standing firm.
This latest round of strikes will show how important our members are to the running of the country and will send a clear message that we want a good deal on job security, pay and conditions for our people. We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
The strikes come at a cost to the economy in terms of lost working days. And the right-wing media here have been counting that cost. Yet that doesn't seem to have dented public support for the strikers.
The cost of living has gone up, so if they need more money, then they should get a pay rise.
I can see where the rail workers are coming from. They want a pay rise. They're seeing their bills go up every month, and they want to make sure they can support their families. At the same time, the government has a really tricky job on its hands to deal with inflation.
I support the strikes and things just because I feel like in certain sectors a lot of people deserve a pay rise anyway at the minute, especially with inflation. But us as travellers on holiday in London as such, obviously it's been a bit of an inconvenience to us.
The rail workers' walkout comes amid a cost of living crisis that's seen food and energy prices soar to 40-year highs since the start of the Ukraine war, pushing millions of Britons into poverty. Staff at the crisis-hit National Health Service will also be going on strike this week for the first time in more than 100 years, and the number of sectors joining the strike action is only growing.
We may not see a general strike in the traditional sense, but the way things are going, it is likely that the different trade unions will synchronize and coordinate their action to maximize their leverage for a better deal with the government. Saeed Pariza, London.
Another attempt to stoke division in Iran by terrorists who would stop at nothing to reach their goal of creating instability. On December 9th, officials in Sistan and Balochistan province said the body of slain Sunni cleric Molevi Abdulwahid Righi, who was kidnapped a day earlier, has been found. According to police reports, on Thursday, a number of unknown individuals took him away in a car that had no license plate.
He was a good person who always tried to help people. He was my student. He always supported the Islamic Republic.
He was a patriotic and religious person. Iran's unity and territorial integrity was very important to him, and he even served in the Iran-Iraq War.
Days before he was kidnapped, he met a delegation representing leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the province. Molevi Abdulwahid Righi always emphasized on the importance of allegiance to the Islamic Republic. In the province, he was seen as a symbol of unity between Shia and Sunni Muslims.
Sistan and Balochistan province is among the regions most affected by the recent farm-backed riots in the country. And this recent assassination is an obvious attempt to stoke division. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Every product showcased carries one same tag, Made in Iran, which is also the title of this exhibition. It's the 10th edition of the annual tech event that brings Iranian local producers under one roof in Tehran to promote their products in a range of industries, from oil and petrochemical sectors to electricity, agriculture, and health.
Quadcopter. To look for example, people or survivor under the rubble, so also we can save them.
We have showcased our 3D printer today. 3D printing can manufacture parts within hours, which speeds up the prototyping process. This allows for each stage to complete faster.
I work in Saadi Foundation. We are trying to develop a Persian language through softwares, and we're trying to make people know about Iran, the truth about Iran.
The expo is a hot marketplace for local tech products, as it gives a chance to manufacturers to trade their products here. In fact, it's a win-win deal for both customers and producers, because any product is sold with as much as 50% discount, funded by Iran's Vice Presidency for Science and Technology, with the aim of supporting domestic production.
Our equipment are considered inventions, so they are not well known. Now, this expo shines a light on our products and has so far helped us find many customers.
Since the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, Tehran has doubled down on its efforts to wean its economy off the ups and downs of politics. While the Iranian government still pursues diplomatic channels with the West, it capitalizes more on domestic production, as it believes this will shield the economy against foreign pressures.
Local brands here say the United States measures have given domestic production a boost in Iran. As they say, the government has made a strategic shift toward an economy that's driven by Made in Iran products. Yusuf Jalali, Press TV, Tehran.
The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan has called on the Taliban to safeguard the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls. The mission said Taliban's edicts and orders in many cases have violated or impinged on the basic rights and freedoms of the population.
The United Nations in Afghanistan is urging the de facto authorities to stop restricting the basic rights of Afghans, especially those of women and girls, because those who govern have an immense responsibility as duty bearers to every woman, man, girl, and boy.
In reaction, the Taliban deputy spokesman said the so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has been committed to ensuring the rights of all Afghans. Bilal Karimi also dismissed the UN mission's stance as unreasonable.
We are committed to upholding human rights under the principles of Islamic law, but the statements published by foreigners can have two reasons. Either they are not aware of our culture and Islamic society, or they neglect our Afghan and Islamic values for political motivations. However, they literally don't care about human rights, but they have problems with Islam and implementation of Islamic orders. Such remarks by them are unjustifiable. Actually, our people did not fight invaders for decades to see Western patterns being practiced in their society.
Human rights activists say the Taliban need to be more flexible and supportive when it comes to the human rights of the Afghan people.
Of course, Afghans are Muslims and have their own culture, but the Taliban should not force people to practice religion according to their point of view. The Taliban are depriving the people of their very fundamental rights. Most of their orders on women are against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which Afghanistan was a signatory.
Serious violations of the rights of women and girls by the Taliban, including the right to education, have added insult to injury caused by the U.S. sanctions on Afghanistan and their impact on the human rights situation in the country. The global community has so far refused to recognize the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Upholding human rights by the de facto administration is mentioned as one of the conditions for the recognition. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Given the lower cost and shorter time of trade via this route, Iran can become the main trade link between Asia and Europe and effectively neutralize the U.S. measures aimed to isolate the Islamic Republic from the global economy. Also, Iran and Venezuela have inked a series of major accords that will definitely make Caracas, its economy, and the welfare of its people immune to any more sabotage by Washington. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Kayhan, international staff writer, wrote, "It is highly said, but for the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran would have continued to be a U.S. client state, and in view of its vast and varied resources, including oil and natural gas, as well as its strategic geopolitical status, a dairy cow to perpetually nourish the Americans." Well, if and but are nothing more than mere wishes stuck in the peanut-sized brains of the ignorantly arrogant Yankees who hate the Islamic Republic and are totally blind to ground realities in Iran and the resolve of its awakened Muslim people. As a result, they continue to imagine that they can still bring back Iran into the American orbit through a bunch of thugs, terrorists, and traitors indulging in the most abominable acts, even if these outcasts of the society are detested by the overwhelming majority of the staunchly Muslim and strongly nationalist Iranian people. The Islamic Republic of Iran is thus the prime example of the repeated failures of Washington's unwise policies, which have failed almost all over the world, as is evident by the inability of the U.S. regime, despite their intensive subversive acts and spending of billions of dollars to try to dupe and buy people, whether in Asia, Africa, or Latin America. The last named continent, which the U.S. used to consider its backyard and spurred no hegemonic plot to plunder its rich resources in order to deprive its people of their heritage, including the right to democracy and independence, has now emerged as a bastion against Anglo-Saxon imperialism. This has angered Uncle Sam, and after decades of sanctions against Cuba that miserably failed, it singled out oil-rich Venezuela. But here also, it has failed to overthrow its fiercely independent government in spite of resorting to every dirty trick, such as economic terrorism and coups that collapse. The Islamic Republic of Iran, as part of its principal policy of helping nations in distress, has built solid bridges with Venezuela and several other Latino states. This policy is reaping rich harvests for Iran, while enabling the victims of U.S. oppression to firmly stand on their feet to fend off Yankee bullying.
other day, Iran and Venezuela inked a series of major accords that will definitely make Caracas, its economy, and the welfare of its people immune to any more sabotage by Washington. Early this year in June, the two countries had signed a 20-year cooperation plan, which involves Iranian assistance in repair and maintenance of Venezuelan refineries, as well as other technical and engineering expertise. The two nations also signed a deal whereby Iran will deliver 4 oil tankers to Venezuela, while weekly flights between Caracas and Tehran commenced in July. Iran, which sends fleets of fuel-laden tanker ships to alleviate Venezuela's crisis and also help export Venezuela's crude oil to defeat U.S. sanctions, had in 2020 launched in Caracas the giant supermarket Megasis, spread some 200,000 square feet and supplying to eager customers over 2,500 different Iranian products. In view of these developments, the recent announcement in Tehran by Venezuelan Minister of Transport Romanov purchase of 1,000 cars built in Iran as part of a major deal for importing the first batch of 80,000 cars from various Iranian car manufacturers came as no surprise. Velazquez, who participated in 7 joint committees of the two countries involving the Venezuelan public sector and the private sector of Iran, concluded agreements in such varied fields as agriculture, industry, science and technology, as well as in health and education. He said, "With Iran, we have built real ties of brotherhood, cooperation and mutual assistance to strengthen bilateral relations in order to realize our dreams of living freely." The U.S. regime is red with rage at Iran's staking out a niche in South America's automotive marketplace, which has a lot of space for growth and expansion, but it cannot do anything except propagandizing false narratives of turmoil in Iran, which the free world doesn't believe. Tehran Times wrote in this regard, "The agreement for launching INSTC was signed by Iran, India and Russia in 2000. However, despite all the interest and hype, the attention to the route faded in time due to geopolitical hurdles, including the global economic stagnation, the U.S. sanctions on Iran, the conflict in Karabakh and the pandemic. Now, the multimodal network of ships, rail and roads is once again gaining its importance as the most important trade link between Asia and Europe. According to official data, one of the major advantages of this transportation route is that the cost of transporting goods through this corridor is cheaper 30%. It also halts the time it takes to transport Indian goods to Russia via the Suez Canal. Iran can use this transit route to distribute European commodities in the shortest possible time and at a lower cost than other routes to the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf." It is predicted that after the full operation of INSTC, Iran will be able to earn $20 billion in transit profits annually, something helping it reduce its dependence on oil revenues amid the American ban on the sector. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been taking serious measures for the development of its railway network as well as its ports and shipping infrastructure in order to encourage more countries to join the project. Using the capacities of INSTC, Iran will be able not only to expand the volume of trade with Russia and the countries of the region, it can also gain a huge share of the mentioned countries' annual transits. Currently, Russia has proposed to take part in some railway projects in Iran in order to accelerate the development of the Islamic Republic's railway network along the mentioned route. Recently, Igor Yevgenyevich Levitin, aide to the President of Russian Federation, visited Iran on the top of a high-ranking delegation to meet with Iranian Transport and Urban Development Minister Rostam Qasemi and discuss the expansion of transport ties. According to the Iranian Transport Ministry, Levitin was tasked by Russian President Vladimir Putin to take the necessary measures for the implementation of Iran's Rasht-Astara railway and the signaling of the country's Incheborun-Garmsar railway line, both of which are along the INSTC route. Besides linking India to Europe via this corridor, Iran can connect Central Asia to the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf. Landlocked countries in Central Asia can use the corridor's railway to access the high seas. Over time, Iran's place in the corridor would become known to all. Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Turkey, Iraq, and Afghanistan have also shown interest in joining the huge project by linking their railways to that of Iran. Earlier this month, Kazakhstan reached an agreement with the Islamic Republic of Iran for using the country's rail network and the southern Shahid Rajai port for transiting goods to the Central Asian and Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, regions. Iran has also been seeking to join its railway with Iraq in order to use the Arab country to facilitate access to the Syrian market. This way, Syria can also be somehow linked to the INSTC. The rail and sea route can also join the Chinese Road and Belt project, which seeks to revive the ancient Silk Road. As one of Iran's major trade partners, China has also shifted to Central Asia and the Caspian Sea to transit its goods to Europe after the eruption of the Eastern Europe crisis, and Iran could play a significant role in delivering Chinese goods to their destinations. The current international conditions have presented Iran with a proper opportunity to play a bold role in the broader implementation of the INSTC and to transform into a regional trade hub by developing its rail and transit infrastructure.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. U.S. lawmakers have passed a record $858 billion annual military spending bill. The unprecedented package is $45 billion more than what President Joe Biden had requested. The bill has allocated billions in producing major weapons systems as well as military aid to Ukraine and Taiwan. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the reasons behind the rise in the U.S. military budget while Americans are embroiled in economic hardship and the consequences of Washington's continuing military support for Ukraine and Taiwan. Joining us on Spotlight, we have activist and commentator Don DeBar, joining us from Ossining, New York. And we also have anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, joining us from San Francisco.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. DeBar. The U.S. Senate, as we know, has passed next year's defense bill, authorizing a record $858 billion in annual military spending. Share with us your perspective on this record-breaking bill, also known as the NDAA.
Well, it's the largest budget of any kind in the history of the world. You can start with that. The U.S. Military budget is the largest single component of the federal budget, and it's by four times, I think, three or four times factor larger than the next largest military budget, which is a budget that's carried on the backs of 1.8 billion people in China, as opposed to 350 million people or 340 million people in the United States. It supports a network, basically a global occupation army that occupies Europe, occupies parts of Asia, Japan particularly, and South Korea, so-called. It occupies a good part of Africa by proxy through AFRICOM and directly. Of course, it occupies the living hell out of the United States. It absorbs much of the effort also in research and development, technology, and other things. It is the not only the elephant in the room, but the elephant and the room and everyone else in it. And it is essentially this diversion of resources that could be feeding, clothing, providing shelter and medical care and education to people who are sorely in need of it around the world, even in the United States, instead is spent on a mission whose ultimate expression would be the extinction of humanity. So I don't know what else to say other than to just describe it in naked terms and let people draw their own conclusions. Other than in one word, I would say is criminal.
Richard Becker, what are your thoughts on the ever-rising military budget of the U.S.?
Well, it's a real obscenity, I think between the time of 9/11, the September 11th in 2001, and over the next 20 years, the best estimates are that at least $20 trillion was spent on war and militarism during that time. And I think that's probably a conservative estimate. But these funds, these unthinkable, unimaginable funds, I think it's very hard for us to even begin to wrap our minds around what these kind of numbers mean. $858 billion, how does one calculate that? But it certainly does its purpose is not to protect the people of the United States. There's nobody threatening the United States. I mean, there's no country that would be so wild and out of control that it would do that. It's to really support the empire. And it is an empire. It's a worldwide empire. And it's kept in power and in place by militarism, by the military. The U.S. is slipping in many ways as far as its being the dominant world power when it comes to economics and finance and diplomacy and so forth. But it still is by far the world's leading military power. It's not something to be proud of. And it's also not something that is accurately reported. The $858 billion, as far as I know, does not include the Central Intelligence Agency. Last year, the Congress gave Central Intelligence Agency and the other intelligence agencies $25 billion more than they asked for. So there was about $85 billion more than that. In the Department of Energy budget, Department of Energy is hidden away there, and not very completely hidden, but money for nuclear weapons, billions and billions of dollars more for nuclear weapons. And so, you know, a great deal of the budget, the overall budget of the United States, really more than half of the discretionary budget of the United States, goes to militarism. And at a time when there is great, great need and great suffering around the world, and inside the United States, and the fundamental problems of lack of health care, adequate housing, adequate food and clean water, a clean environment, these problems could be addressed and overcome if those kind of funds were spent not on war, but on meeting the needs of the people of this country and the world.
Don DeBar, the bill also provides Ukraine with additional security assistance in its war with Russia, $800 million to be exact. It also includes a range of provisions to aid Taiwan amid tensions with China. On the issue of Ukraine, is the plan to stretch this war out for as long as possible?
I think that's really a tactical question that I don't know the answer to, because the strategic objective, they've been pretty clear about it, is to basically regime change in Russia and a dismantling of the Russian Federation. They are now openly talking about this at the State Department, and they are actively holding public fora in various places with groups that they hold out as repressed nationalities in the Russian Federation, building basically quote-unquote liberation movements. They're doing or trying to do what was done to the Soviet Union in 1991. I believe some people in policymaking positions there have the illusion or the delusion that they're going to be able to recreate 1991 and have the Russian Federation collapse and be dismantled by making war. However, there are some steps that are being taken now that are intrinsically escalatory that have a much sharper curve towards, you know, total war, basically, between Russia and the U.S. and its puppet states in Europe. And we're talking now about the delivery of Patriot missiles, warnings from Russia that if you have Patriot missile batteries targeting our aircraft, we're going to be taking them out. The U.S., of course, would have American soldiers and military personnel and civilian personnel operating those batteries. And so there will be American casualties as a direct result of direct retaliatory strikes by Russia. This goes nowhere but directly to World War III in full. And that seems to be happening pretty quickly at the moment.
Richard Becker, amid rising tensions with China, this bill has allocated billions in defense support for Taiwan, as well as the fast-tracked weapons procurement. Now, a think tank senior advisor says it would also create a regional contingency stockpile, which would allow the Pentagon to put weapons in Taiwan for use if a military conflict with China arises. Now, have the consequences of such measures been thought through, in your opinion?
I think they've been swept through by the policymakers, by the people who are carrying out this policy in Asia, in the Indo-Pac, as they call it, command. You know, it's not discussed a lot, but part of the strategy, and this was explained by the outgoing Admiral Philip Davidson, who was the head of the Indo-Pac command last year when he was leaving office. And he said, you know, the first island chain countries have to be prepared not only for war, but for redundancy. And that was a very interesting statement, I thought. In other words, this first island chain means Japan, Okinawa, Taiwan, the Philippines, Borneo, and possibly other countries. But what he was saying, and I think this continues down till today, is that they have to be built up militarily so that even if a war occurs, and of course it's in anticipation of a war with China, that they'll get hit, they'll suffer casualties and destruction, but that's fine from the U.S. policymakers' point of view. But what they have to do is they have to be able to be redundant, meaning that they have to have so much weaponry that they can continue fighting or continuing serving as the bases for the United States to continue the war against China until victory. So it's important to point this out because on one hand, it shows there's no concern whatsoever for the people of those countries or the people of China. It's cold-blooded approach to war. And also this kind of planning means that the United States is disregarding the Shanghai Communique, and they have been for quite some time now. Shanghai Communique was signed 50 years ago in 1972, recognizing that there was, and it said, on both sides of the strait, everyone recognizes that there is one China. Now the U.S. is treating Taiwan not as part of China, and it hasn't been, as I said, for a while. It is treating it as a completely independent country that is an ally and a military ally, most important of all, to the United States. Very, very dangerous.
Don DeBar, Washington is not shying away from cranking up tensions with China, but the repercussions of that, like with the situation similar in Ukraine, it could be devastating.
Yeah. You know, and the real scary thing is, there's a couple of things that are going on. In addition to what Richard just said, by the way, there's been an ongoing drive practice to remilitarize Japan, both in terms of armament and also in terms of mission, because they're now talking about having Japan more or less patrol on behalf of the alliance, quote unquote, certain areas. Where they'd be facing down China. With the history of that, that's a pretty frightening thought all by itself. but you have a situation in Washington where, let's say, looking at Ukraine, Bernie Sanders is talking about trying to call up the War Powers Resolution on the Congress, and he can't do it even on Yemen. Instead, you have an 83-11 majority in the Senate for this, for the budget and for these policies where they're beefing up Taiwan for a war with China. So it's kind of hard to figure out where the political breaks would be on the gallop towards war, almost on every front. You know, they're fighting in Africa in five or six different places, And even someone has tried to assassinate, I don't know his status at this point, at one of the Russian staff people in the Central African Republic. You've got, of course, Ukraine war, Yemen war, the chest thumping in Asia around both Korea and China with the United States and South Korea and Japan. And they're increasing the budget by 5% more than they asked for, and the request was a record. I don't know how you find breaks inside the political system or inside even a legal construct to put on this thing that looks like it's going to be a global war. It's maturing in front of our eyes.
Sure. Richard Becker, let's turn our focus now to inside the United States. Doesn't the average U.S. citizen think that there are more pressing issues other than overseas military spending? The country continues to be hit by exceptionally high inflation, with almost every other major economic indicator also being mired in long-term problems.
Well, yes. You know, there's been a very intensive and extensive propaganda campaign inside the United States in support of the U.S.-NATO proxy war in Ukraine. And I think that this is something that, you know, has affected the population because it's so incredibly one-sided. It's so one-sided that, you know, we had a couple months ago the members of the Progressive Caucus in Congress sent a letter to President Biden, and the letter said, oh, we salute you. And it wasn't even anti-war. It was like, we salute you for the war effort, the military aid to Ukraine, and so forth. I mean, really kind of disgraceful for people who are supposed to be anti-war. But they said then, well, but, you know, maybe we could also have negotiations. And there was a huge response to that from not only the Biden administration, and not only by the Republicans, but by the leaders of the Democrats in Congress. And they retracted the letter in one day. And I bring this up because it shows how intense the propaganda campaign for the Ukraine war. And the Ukraine war, you know, it's a terrible war. And it's a war between peoples who just a little over three decades ago were part of the same country and who share a lot in the way of the history and culture and religion, language, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's very tragic that it's taking place. Having said that, it is clear that it was the U.S. and NATO, and particularly the U.S., that refused any negotiations ahead of time that could have staved off this crisis. It could have avoided this crisis and this war. And that's where the primary responsibility lies. They've surrounded Russia to a large degree, or European Russia, with their military allies, and they were trying to complete it by bringing in Ukraine, which would have been the most devastating to Russia's national security to have NATO in Ukraine and NATO weaponry in Ukraine. So, you know, there's been all the propaganda, and it's, you know, washed over people, but we in the anti-war movement here, we're planning activities next month around the time of the Martin Luther King Day commemorations, remembering King's opposition to the war in Vietnam and to wars around the world, and highlighting that. And, you know, we have to reach out to the population and try to counter that propaganda to the greatest extent possible.
Donabar, putting into question the timing of this bill, the U.S. national debt, if I'm correct, now stands at around $31 trillion. Does this show basically how threatened Washington could be by the major economic powers which are emerging, and with it, an emerging multipolar world?
Well, the first thing it shows is the priorities of the people who make the budget. People in the United States are more housing distressed, healthcare distressed, food distressed, just about everything, infrastructure distressed, as they've been in decades. And it's deteriorating on the back of inflation that's eating away at whatever money people have aside or in their pocket, and also just in terms of the dismantling of entire economic nodes, you know, supply lines and all of this. And that's becoming institutionalized. In other words, it's just a continuing degrading of the condition of people in the United States. And it also shows that they do, of course, take note of the rising multipolarity in the world. And they are, rather than sitting back and trying to engage it and saying, okay, well, we could be first among peers or something along those lines and satisfy themselves with being sort of president of a college of the rulers of the world, they're going for the gusto, and they're willing to blow up the world. They're showing us that they're willing to go to the brink in order to accomplish that, and they're spending the money on the weapons that can do it, and they're starting to use them.
Richard Becker, U.S. senators backed the bill by an overwhelming 83-11 bipartisan majority. There's a lot of talk about the great divide in U.S. politics, but politicians, they can still produce bipartisan consensus when it's needed. And there's always consensus on wars and military spending in America. Am I right?
There's always consensus on the war. I mean, it's only in the most extreme conditions where the war has been lost, like in the last years of the Vietnam War, that there's real opposition and even rejection at some points of military budgets. But other than that, year in, year out, you know, we hear how, you know, difficult it is to get anything good for the people through the Congress, how we, you know, but then when the military budget time comes around, it's like it just almost automatic that it goes through. And the corporate mass media in the United States is very linked to the also to the military industrial corporations and the banks, and they're all linked together and with the oil companies, and they benefit from this. They benefit from war. They are the beneficiaries of this military policy, and everybody else constitute the losers when it comes to militarism.
And same question to you, Mr. DeBar. Disagreements on issues like guns, abortion, health care, but it seems like the partisan bickering and infighting, the line is drawn when it comes to the issue of militarism.
You know, you can have disagreements about all of those issues, and before you decide who's right and who's wrong, find that all of the people who are arguing end up as radioactive wisps of steam. And then how significant are these other issues in the face of that? And that is where we're at.
All right. I guess we're going to wrap it up. Any final thoughts from you, Mr. DeBar?
Yeah, just in general, the resources that are being expended right now could be used to house and clothe and feed half the population of the world that's in severe distress over those things, including the 9 or 10 or 12 million people that will die of starvation this year alone. These are products of U.S. foreign policy and of the U.S. budget process that could be resolved with one person in the White House with executive power exercising that, or a Congress that has some human beings in it instead of a bunch of vampires.
Richard Becker, would you like to add anything to that final comments?
No, I'd like to concur with that comment. And I'd also like to say that I think if people want to see where all the money is going, Google U.S. Military commands worldwide or something like that, and see this incredible situation that has never existed before in human history, where the whole world is encompassed in the military command.